Chapter 1. Dave Chappelle blasted for white privilege after saying gender is real.
Come on, everyone. Jeremy here from The Quartering, and this might be the most hilarious criticism I've seen of Dave Chappelle. Now, I covered some of the initial pushback on Dave Chappelle, and it would appear now that more people have seen his stand-up special, they've decided that he is benefiting from, and I want you to follow me here, Dave Chappelle, a black man, is the beneficiary of white privilege. Leave a like on this video if you just laughed out loud. And subscribe if you haven't, the red subscribe button down below. Now is the closer special. The reviews are coming in, and the faux outrage is essentially proving Dave Chappelle right. He talked about several poignant things in the video. He also talked about, you know, essentially saying, you know, he made a comment about how many genders there are. He made comments about, you know, you can't hurt certain people's feelings. Well, he's essentially right about these things, and people are outraged. And before I get into it, I need to give myself a little extra. I think you do too. Check this out. Huge shout out to this video's sponsor, Scentbird. Hey, as seasons change, your scent should follow suit. The heavier scents you may have loved in fall and winter might be too strong for warm weather, and alternatively, the lighter scents you used in the spring and summer might not be strong enough for all those winter layers. Consider joining Scentbird, where you can discover new seasonal favorites every single month. Scentbird allows you to choose a new designer fragrance to try every month. That's just $16. Every month, you get to pick what you want to receive, and there are no surprises. With each fragrance, you'll get a 30-day supply, so you can try out fragrances before committing to a full-size bottle. Scentbird carries top designer brands like Prada, Gucci, and Versace, but also indie labels like The Harmonist and Confessions of a Rebel. With Scentbird, you get a decent amount of high-end fragrances for just $16. And with my code, it'll just be $11 a month. The scent they sent me this month, Tommy Bahama Maritime. It has mandarin, violet leaves, cedar leaf, and cashmere wood. Check out these applicators. You just twist it and it pops up and you spray, boom. Really easy to take with you. They also sent me John Varvatos and English Laundry Armor. I ended up with three different scents. I can kind of pick and choose what I want to do each day. I'm really enjoying the Tommy Bahama for its cedar leaf. It feels kind of fall-esque for me. Pick yourself up some wonderful new scents. Hey, it's a great way to try out a bunch and figure out exactly what you like. And if you use my link in the description, you'll save 30% off and support the channel. So check out Scentbird using my link in the description below. That's right, get smelling better. Dave Chappelle. NPR is accusing Dave Chappelle of using white privilege. Too often, the closer, it just sounds like Chappelle is using white privilege to excuse his own phobias, wrote NPR television critic Eric Deggans. Following the release of Dave Chappelle's latest Netflix special, The Closer, the famous comedian is receiving criticism for how he tackled topics of gay rights and race. Too often in The Closer, it sounds like Chappelle is using his white privilege to excuse his own phobias. And the message Chappelle has for those who have criticized him about his phobic comments or any other phobic joke seems to be, race trumps all, wrote Deggans. Deggans points to a line where Chappelle joked that if slaves had oil and booty shorts on, we might have been free 100 years sooner. Jeez. But lines like that assume that the struggle over oppression is a zero-sum game. Because some gay people have access to white privilege, all their concerns about stereotyping and marginalization are hollow and subordinate to what black people face, wrote Deggans. It ignores the fact that there are plenty of non-white gay people who face oppression for both their orientation and their race. His continued his defense, and yes, the racial issues in societies trump 2SLGBTQQIA+ issues. What? What's the 2 for? And what's S now? When did this go? What are all these? What's this extra Q now? What? If you have a plus, doesn't that mean like you don't need letters for everything? I don't know. Chappelle told a story about how he nearly got into a fight with a gay man who then called the PD. He picked up his phone and called the PD, Chappelle said to the Detroit crowd. And this thing I'm describing is a major issue that I have with that community. gay people are minorities until they need to be white again. In the special, Chappelle says, clearly my problem has always been white people. I've been arguing with whites my entire career. He also points out to an earlier story in which where Chappelle talks about rapper DaBaby and comments that he made were perceived as phobic, received more attention than DaBaby actually ending a human life. Well, that was true. Chappelle also took flack for comments from the trans community defending author J.K. Rowling, who is a trans activist, who trans activists have tried to cancel for being considered a TERF or a trans exclusionary radical feminist. They've canceled people that are more powerful than me. Cancel J.K. Rowling. My God, J.K. Rowling wrote all the Harry Potter books by herself. She sold so many books that the Bible worries about her. And they canceled it because she said in an interview that it isn't exactly what she said, but it's effectively what she said, that gender is a fact. And the trans community gap man, I don't know what that means, started calling her a TERF. I believe he also says he is Team TERF. For Dave Chappelle, punchlines are dares. His new special, The Closer, goes too far. I don't think there should be any too far in comedy. I'm going to be watching, hanging out with a good friend tonight who is a stand-up comedian. Well, a new friend who's a stand-up comedian. And I'll actually have an interview with him on the channel probably tomorrow, if everything goes well. And, you know, these are some of the questions I want to ask him is like, you know, I think for me, comedy, I actually like, you know, like groaners, like groan, like jokes at me. Ugh, you know, like, ugh, I probably shouldn't laugh at that. Like mix those in, you know, I like dark comedy. I like dark humor. It's not for everybody, but to say that it's gone too far or that, you know, it shouldn't be allowed or that it should be censored, that's not something I'm ever going to support. Even if it is truly offensive, it's a comedy bit. You can like literally just not watch it or listen to it. Dave Chappelle is one of the most brilliant stand-up comedians in the business, but he also makes a sport of challenging his audience, putting ideas in front of them that he knows are uncomfortable and unpalatable to those invested in modern notions of how to talk about feminism, gender, orientation, or race. Sometimes he does it to make a larger point. But at times, especially during his latest special for Netflix, The Closer, he seems to have a daredevil's relish for going to dangerous places on stage and eventually winning his audience over, regardless of what he's actually saying. And of course, these days the fix is in. Chappelle is considered the greatest of all time among many comedy fans. He's not the greatest of all time, but he's the greatest of our time. I'd listen to that. I mean, Norm Macdonald's pretty dang good too. Richard Pryor's pretty dang good. You know, Eddie Murphy in his stand-up days, Chris Rock. There are a lot of great stand-up comedians. You know, I'm there's too many to name. Mitch Hedfield, so many. He says about himself, Riley, toward the end of the special, The Closer, finds himself surrounded by an enthusiastic audience in Detroit, ready to go wherever he takes them. That much is obvious. Early in the special, he talks about an idea for a film centered about ancient civilizations that discovered space travel, left the planet, then came back, determined to claim Earth for their own. His punchline is titled for the film Space Jews. Even if the adoring audience in Detroit took a deep breath at that one, it's going to get worse than that, Chappelle retorts laughing. But I'm not sure it did, because that was pretty awful. It's coming from Chappelle, a joke that felt like a dare. He knows in the moment that such a punchline will briefly break the spell he has on the audience, make them rethink their allegiance to him, at least for a second, and he'll have to work a little to get them back on his team again, which he does. He also knows reviewers like me will quote the joke and criticize him for it, which I am. I don't really care what point he's trying to make. A joke sounds like anti-Semitism gets a hard pass from me. I mean, again, I talked about this last night. I was talking to Mike Carlo on his channel. You know, intent matters. There is obviously issues like with some of the comments that, what's that one guy, Nick Cannon makes. Like when he talks about Jewish people, I believe that there's malicious intent behind what he's saying. DeSean Jackson, I think it was, Philadelphia Eagle, if I'm wrong about that name, I apologize, but there was some Eagles receiver that said something like, you know, I believe that that is actually rooted in hate. But I don't know that Dave Chappelle really hates people. He's just making a joke that, you know, 5 years ago, everyone would have laughed about. I mean, jokes about the power of the Jewish community is like, you know, a staple in comedy, and has been, you know, until recently when the pearl clutching started. The message that Chappelle has for those who criticize him about his phobic or any other phobic joke seems to be race trumps all. He gets all upset. Here's another article. Dear White People EP, done with Netflix over Dave Chappelle's new transphobic special. Comic lambasted by GLAAD for ridiculing. Again, this is another conversation I talked with Mike about, who is gay. You know, to me, and maybe this is wrong, but and it's probably too reductive, but like, I've always thought if I were a member of that community, I would just want to be treated the same as anyone else, which includes being the butt of jokes. Now, there are jokes you can tell that are jokes, and there are jokes that are like meant to be mean-spirited or, you know, I think that there's nuance there that people who write these articles know. They know this. They don't actually think Dave Chappelle has a problem with this community, but they need to fake being outraged. There's nuance there. And if Dave Chappelle is like, you know, some sort of phobic jerk and a bigot, I mean, it really hasn't come out except for jokes he's told. So I think that, you know, him saying Team Turf, I don't really think it's that shocking for somebody to come out and say that gender is real. It is real. You know, for me, my position has always been, hey, you do you as long as it doesn't infringe on anybody else's rights. And, you know, if you want to say you're, you know, you identify as something else, good for you. Okay. But when if we talk about laws or we talk about compelling speech, like they do in Canada now, where the Supreme or their court ruled that you have to respect people's pronouns or something like that, that's not okay. You know, critics blast, called to cancel Dave Chappelle, Netflix for ridiculing trans people. Again, I know a few trans people, you know, online we talk. I don't think, you know, in their words, and maybe the people that I hang out with are just more like open with it. But like, again, if you want to be like everyone else, that includes accepting making jokes about you. Again, if they're really mean-spirited or whatever, okay, then you might have a case. But I didn't really hear anything that I thought was deeply mean-spirited. But Chappelle knows exactly what he's doing. All this is going to do is get way more people to watch his Netflix special. And it's absolutely hilarious. I think you should watch it. It's probably not his best stand-up, but it's basically some of the best stuff you're going to see. And I'm actually surprised that Netflix has kept it up.
Chapter 2. Netflix star Zazie Beetz declared not black enough for the woke mob.
I know that Netflix is not having a good day, and anytime that happens, I feel like we're all having a little bit of a better day. Now, I'm not saying that literally everything on Netflix is garbage, but most of it is. Like 99% of the content that Netflix puts out is absolute garbage. I wouldn't have it if I didn't need it for this channel. I just sometimes have to suffer through things so that I can speak about it from a place of, you know, honesty, right? Sometimes you can critique things without watching them, but it's better if you at least dedicate the time so you're being, you know, honest about it. You know, there are certain exceptions out there, like movies like Ghostbusters 2016, nobody really needs to watch to know that it's terrible. That said, Netflix is now getting dragged for lightwashing. Essentially, they cast a black actress, by the way, a wonderful black actress from Deadpool, Zazie Beetz, for hiring a black actress to play a black role, I want to get this right, who isn't black enough. I just want to reiterate that. They are being canceled because they hired a black actress to play a black role for not being black enough. When are we going to stop giving in to all this absolute absurdity? It's ridiculous. Netflix accused of light washing after casting Zazie Beetz as historical figure stagecoach Mary in The Harder They Fall. Netflix's decision to cast Deadpool 2 actress Zazie Beetz as the freed slave turned mail carrier and gunfighter Mary stagecoach Mary in their upcoming Western, The Harder They Fall, has drawn accusations of light washing from social media, quote, critics. These are just losers, by the way, not critics, who have taken issue with the fact that the upcoming film does not accurately portray the real world appearance of the historical figure. Is that where we're at now? You know, was anybody really, you know, when you see George Washington has been portrayed, I don't know, maybe 1,000 times in modern media. Does anybody get upset that it didn't look exactly like George Washington? Did anybody get upset that, you have a situation where like, oh, Robert Downey Jr. doesn't look exactly like I thought Sherlock Holmes should look, or Superman doesn't look like the real Superman? It's ridiculous. Now, I do know that obviously race swapping is a big thing Netflix loves to do. And it's a thing in modern media, which is cringe, but it's not really like, all right, I'm just not going to watch it because I know why you're doing it. It's for simple political ideology. In this particular case, they hired a black woman with an afro to play a black woman. I need to see this. And I love Western, so I don't know. Maybe I'll have to watch this. Directed by James with a Y, Samuel, and co-written by him by himself, The Harder They Fall tells a fictionalized tale of revenge centered around a real-world cowboy, Nat Love's quest to reunite his gang of black Wild West icons to enact revenge against those that ended his parents. Classic revenge Western tale seems good enough to me. One such member of the gang, Fields, portrayed as I mentioned above by Betts, born into a life of American slavery in 1832, this is an actual character, not her, but her character, Fields was emancipated following the conclusion of the Civil War before eventually securing work at the age of 60 as the country's first black African-American female star route mail carrier. Wait, she's not a star. She's just a mail carrier back then, right? During her tenure as mail carrier, Mary proved to be both fearless in the face of danger, carrying multiple firearms with her on routes to stave off wild animals and robbers, and reliable, never missing even a single day of her route assignments. Sounds like an awesome character to make, an awesome person to make a movie about. Eventually, her tenacious reputation, as well as her preferred option of travel, earned her the nickname Stagecoach Mary. Now, you can see here, this is an actual picture of Mary Fields. Yes, she is very dark black, and Zazie Beetz is, I don't know if she's mixed or what the case is, but she's lighter skinned. That's, you know, the way I would put it. However, despite both of them being black, the latter's casting as a former was met with backlash from Twitter users who felt the film had done a disservice to the historical figure by portraying her as more light-skinned than she actually was. Y'all better not put that white woman on my screen, wrote Ghost Shivs, erasing Beetz's ethnicity in the process. Now, I don't know if she's, you know, again, I understand it's a thing in the black community, you know, judging each other on the lightness or darkness of their skin and this perception that, you know, you're more or less black based on the opacity of your skin tone. I think it's ridiculous. But maybe, you know, some of my black viewers could justify it to me, but it doesn't seem, you know, it doesn't seem like a productive thing to do. Similarly, I am not heaven asserted. Y'all really picked a mutt that don't wash her rear. I don't really know about not washing her rear or her showering habits. You called her a mutt? So maybe she is a mixed race? I guess? Stop tweeting. And this is like Netflix, who tweeted this out. Stop tweeting us this pro-black stuff, if you're going to keep colorism going in your films and shows, she is not plus-sized and she's not dark-skinned. She should not have been cast. As much money as y'all have over there, this is a constant color. This constant colorism is ridiculous. I suppose they could have cast, what's her name? She was in Ma, the horror film. And then she's in that terrible movie with Melissa McCarthy where there's like queef superheroes. And she's kind of plus sized. I don't know. Interestingly, a number of critics also took issue with herself, particularly how she agreed to take the role despite being less than accurate to Fields' historical appearance. By the way, it's never the actor's or actress's fault. This is absolutely absurd. When Netflix ain't got S better to do, shake my head. And Zazie Beetz knew better, but chose not to do better when she took this role and ignored the implications. What exactly are the implications? Is it more important to you that Stagecoach Mary's story is told, or is it that it must be told by the right-looking person, or told by the person who maybe best fits the role, who can execute it the best? Or is it more important to you that they look exactly like them? Would you choose a inferior actress for this role if she looked more like the actual Stagecoach Mary? That's the question. And if the answer is yes, then I don't really know where your priorities lie. What the heck is this, Netflix? Due to her belief that y'all know good and well this is BS. I hope this original fails because y'all wanted to use a non-dark-skinned person to portray a dark-skinned person. Fix it, Stagecoach Mary. She should have said no. She added she knows good and well that she didn't fit the role. I don't know. I mean, this is this like world that these weirdos live in who need every actor and actress. Well, see, it never goes the other way, by the way. These same people aren't piping up when Anne Boleyn is cast to be a black woman. I bet you these people, where was this energy then? Well, they should be just as mad that a black actress is playing Anne Boleyn, don't you think? Anne Boleyn is an actual fictional character. So where was the criticism then? Where's the criticism when somebody who is gay plays a straight character? And we just talked about this stupid idea of Jew face from Sarah Silverman earlier this week. Nobody who consumes Hollywood products actually cares about this. I mean, Zazie is a smoking hot woman who I would love to see in more films. And if she doesn't match Mary Field's personal, physical attributes exactly, I don't think that actually diminishes the tale at all. And it seems odd to me that people would be this upset. At this point, we know the studios were trying to pull this, but come on, it's on the actors to not to take that. Take some responsibility. She's wrong for taking this role. With the outrage being directed towards Netflix for the casting, one wonders if the same critics... Oh, here we go. Yeah, same issues as blackwashing history seen as Channel 5's Anne Boleyn series, legendary graphic novel based on the life of the 18th century boxer Elizabeth Wilkinson, or Netflix Bridgerton. It never goes the other way, and it's also never good enough. And honestly, I don't really know any other way to classify this type of criticism other than just racism. Calling her a mutt, calling her, not black enough. I know I'm not obviously qualified to speak on how things go in the black community. But to me, the simple, white guy from the Midwest, this seems racist. And if the people who talk like this about other people are the ones you're trying to please, I don't really know if it's worth it.
Chapter 3. Male feminists meltdown over OK Boomer Girl not making enough money after Twitch leaks.
The best part of the Twitch leaks are they are the gift that keeps on giving, and we're getting some amazing hot takes from the usual suspects. Outside of not really being shocked that very popular people make a lot of money, some of the hilarity surrounding the story has been in the reaction from the media and certain other notorious socialist streamers like multimillionaire Nico Lull, and double multimillionaire Hassan Piker, both hilariously, desperately trying to maintain their socialist aesthetic while being outed as being a part of the top 0.01%. Now, I have no problem with making money, but these people don't actually want to be taxed more. They want to be elites, just like all these commie LARPers want to. And now that we know a little bit more about what is getting paid, we're also finding out that certain streamers are protected. They get protected status because money. So let's start with the, of course, the male feminist perspective here. Only 3% of Twitch's top earning streamers are women, apparently. Hey, get good, scrubs. I don't know what to tell you. If you believed what the media says, you know, I can't go 5 minutes online without seeing an ad for Pokimane or Valkyrie or some of these other female streamers, Amaranth, all extraordinarily popular and successful. I probably couldn't name 10 male streamers, but I could definitely name 10 female streamers. So maybe they don't make the millions that the, top gentlemen do, but I guess, you know, the patriarchy is real. I don't really know what to say. Like, get good. This isn't a gender issue. Put out a better product. I would argue that there are definitely disadvantages to being a female streamer, but there are also advantages to being a female streamer that men just don't have. Here's the article. Only 3%. This morning, an anonymous hacker leaked, of course, the 125 gigabytes. The unverified list of Twitch payouts screenshotted by a Twitter user seems to show how much income the top make. So apparently, I guess I don't really care. According to the figures, Twitch's top earning streamers are overwhelmingly male. The top spot is occupied by a role-playing collective with 9.6 million. By the way, there are plenty of females a part of that, but they are ignoring that. Followed by a male Overwatch streamer at 8.4. These supposed figures do not account for sponsorships and other methods. But the highest-ranking female streamers are far further down the list, starting with Valorant streamer Pokimane at 39th place, cosplayer Amaranth at 48th, and music streamer Syntica at 71st. Excluding streams that are run by multiple people, such as Critical Role, there are no women in the top third earnings. Get good. In spite of the complaints of the hot tub meta and Bob streamers, and how some male streamers perceive that female streamers are stealing views from men, I don't believe there are really, I don't believe that to be the case. The numbers show that only a small percentage of women are among the ranks at Twitch's highest earning content creators. So women suck at streaming? Is that what Kotaku is really saying here? It sure would appear that way, wouldn't it? It sure seems that, women suck at streaming. I didn't say that. I'm not saying that. Kotaku.com is saying that. All that energy we spend crying about how women were making a dangerous precedent amidst incels shouting about Bob streamers, and they're not even in the same grouping for payouts. Find a black person in the top earners list while you're at it. I don't even know what Kotaku is even applying. What are they implying here? Is it that women aren't good at streaming or entertaining? I certainly disagree with that. As a proud feminist male, I think the women are just as good as men. I know that may be radical, but it would appear that Kotaku doesn't like it. These figures are missing a lot of information. A bunch of different revenue streams are missing from my understanding, not to mention, quote, hot tub streamers drive traffic off Twitch's platform and generate the majority of their revenue from other platforms like OnlyFans. I am sure if you included Amaranth's OnlyFans, she would be in the top five. Didn't she say she made $1 million a month? It's awfully convenient. You could see, Destiny here is a good example. He makes 10K a month off Twitch, according to this leak. He currently pays the editor of his YouTube channel 40% of the revenue generated from it, which is an average of 10 to 15K a month. I've heard other streamers getting paid sponsorship deals that pay 10 to 20K an hour. People just don't understand how much money Twitch streamers are really generating. And generally, most content creators don't want you to know. I don't think that, you know, it's anyone's business necessarily what other people earn. But yeah, I mean, what your salary is your business and mine is mine. But I do think it's funny when you have the, again, the socialist aesthetic, right? Tax the rich. This is, so Nicole, I'll post this out. Remember her, tax the rich, and then here she bought a fancy new BMW, and she did a tour of her $2 million apartment, and here's the tweet. All the Twitch leak showed me is that we need to keep pushing for diversity. No, it showed me that you have to get good. I mean, what are you selling? Look at your profile photo. I'm not saying you can't do it, okay? I'm saying I love them. I love those bobs. They look delicious. They look great, voluptuous. If I were a single man, I would love the opportunity to motorboat them. However, maybe that isn't what people actually want on Twitch. Now, you could make the statement that you don't even have to be amazing at video games to be popular on Twitch. There are popular Twitch streamers who are very good at video games, but there are also plenty of Twitch streamers that are just average. Even Dr. Disrespect, Tim the Tapman, Nick Merckx, these guys are good, but they're not the best. But what they are is entertaining. People make personal decisions based on you know, what their preference is. Maybe it's an unconscious thing, but I find men and women equally entertaining on Twitch. It just depends the type of content that they're putting out. Could you imagine if there was like a female Dr. Disrespect who had that level of production? I think I'd get down with that. How come nobody innovates there? Now, Doc is in a category of his own, but let's not act like Valkyrie isn't one of the most popular female streamers in the world. She happens to stream on YouTube. The Twitch leak has also revealed a do not ban list with people like Ricegum on it. Twitch recently had a massive security breach, which included important parts of the website being leaked online. Some of the leaked items are the website source code, creator revenue, and a do not ban list that seems to offer certain creators immunity from being banned, instantly suspended after violation. It's unknown how up-to-date the list is, but it seems that various creators, along with the reason why they shouldn't be banned if they commit a violation. For example, on October 7th, the list shows streamers like DJ Wheat, Ricegum, and LolTyler1 alongside each person on the list. It says reason with a specific to each creator. One person featured on the list is Emma Shear, co-founder and CEO of Twitch TV, whose username is Sarvandia, is listed as reason CEO staff do not ban for literally any reason. He's not the only big name with the do not ban list. Tyler 1, Ricegum both appear for similar reasons. Do not suspend, escalate violations to email at twitch.tv. With staff being told to escalate both creators and specific staff members, it seems as if the platform gives special treatment when they are in violation of a rule. Now, I am not a career Twitch streamer. This doesn't offend me. You know, that's not a big deal to me. But I could see how this would definitely rub some people the wrong way, simply because, you know, you should all be living by the same rules. But let's be honest, I don't think somebody like PewDiePie is going to get insta-banned off YouTube without some sort of intervention from, you know, somebody at YouTube. There's definitely a protected class on YouTube that they can do things that I can't do. They can talk about things that I can't talk about. That sucks. I understand it completely, though, from a business perspective. A lot of people are annoyed by this, but I just don't really care. I think it's more hilarious that out of all of this, they choose to make this about gender and social justice issues rather than, I don't know, Twitch having a horrible security breach and probably is going to get some sort of class action lawsuit from creators that didn't want their salaries out there. Like, I could see the argument for somebody like Hassan, being able to legitimately make a court case and say that, hey, this hurt my grift, this hurt my ability to make money, and that's their fault, and he could end up suing them. All in all, you know, the communist LARP is alive and well on Twitch.
Chapter 4. Very concerning news about Ghostbusters Afterlife.
Like, I've been on record pretty consistently that I am really completely indifferent about Ghostbusters Afterlife. I understand the original actors are part of it, but the movie's coming too late to me. I was driving home from Chicago this morning and I was thinking about Ghostbusters Afterlife and thinking about how, you know, it's probably worth giving it a chance as long as I go into the theater thinking this isn't a Ghostbusters movie. Because to be honest, the trailer to me seems like it's a Stranger Things ripoff. I mean, partly because of the actors involved, but also partly because of the aesthetic. I don't really want to see, you know, kids saving the world. That's just not movies for me. That definitely would appeal to a younger generation. Maybe that's who they're tailoring this to. But to me, the original Ghostbusters, they were comedies, certainly, but also horrors, I thought. Not in the same way that, like, Michael Myers or Jason Voorhees, you know, legacies are horror films. But, I mean, I find there were moments of genuine fear in the original Ghostbusters. Even in the second one, that painting of Viggo still haunts me. So when, you know, Ghostbusters Afterlife was announced and they gave me all these memo berries and said, hey, Ivan Reitman, and we're going to have the right people on this, and it's going to be, you know, loyal to the original. Okay, I've decided I'm going to give the movie a chance. But now I'm very concerned after reading a few articles here. Ghostbusters 2016 influenced Ghostbusters Afterlife story. Now, this is extraordinarily concerning for me because Ghostbusters 2016 is a movie that literally gave me PTSD and is probably the worst thing that's ever happened to modern film. That said, even in terms of, you know, in like canonically, Ghostbusters 2016, they came out and said, hey, we're not a part of this. We're not a part of the original Ghostbusters lore. We're not a part of, you know, the original storyline. We're doing our own thing, which is mostly queef jokes. But hey, the 11 people that saw that movie, they might have liked it. But now, despite the Ghostbusters Answer the Call standing as one of the most magnificent cinematic disasters in recent years, Ghostbusters Afterlife director Jason Reitman has somehow managed to pull a positive aspect from amidst the wreckage. Now, if you remember all the hubbub with Ghostbusters Afterlife, the director came out and blamed fans, attacked men, saying that, well, if you don't see Ghostbusters 2016, then you're a sexist and you're part of the problem. Well, the fact of the matter was Ghostbusters 2016 was an abomination. Even Melissa McCarthy distanced herself from this film afterwards. I understand wanting to get a paycheck, but this was the assembly of some of the least funny women on the planet being extraordinarily unfunny. And they made sure to have the only male role character in the film, a bumbling buffoon. Shocking. Then when they went to battle with the fandom, all these articles came out. This is always an interesting thing to do when you take a franchise like Ghostbusters or something. And I don't know if Ghostbusters is inherently a movie that is loved by men more than women. It doesn't seem like it would be that case. Maybe it is. But no. First of all, nobody wants an all whatever reboot of whatever. Not just Ghostbusters 2016 or Ghostbusters. Okay, the fact that you did, and you're like, hey, we have these terribly unfunny women. It was a recipe for disaster from the beginning. Speaking to SFX Magazine, by the way, this is via Bounding into Comics.com. For the October issue, Reitman asserted that Paul Feig, who's a piece of garbage, directed the 2016 reboot. No, it wasn't a reboot. It was a reimagining. Helped him personally take interest in the idea that the Ghostbusters could be anyone, in which he turned expanded in Ghostbusters Afterlife, while always focusing on the family aspect and the history that was created by the original films. Every Ghostbusters film up until now has been the opening of a company, friendship through the window of business, says Reitman. And I wanted to make a movie about family. As has been previously revealed, Ghostbusters Afterlife will follow the family of Dr. Egon Spengler, particularly his grandkids, as they discover the history of the founding Ghostbusters' involvement with the paranormal and fight back against the horrors left over from events of the original film. There's a couple of things that I thought I have a problem with, and I know I'm just being a Ghostbusters stickler, okay? I understand this. Remember how the original Ghostbusters movie made such a big deal about how heavy the proton packs were? Like, they literally, you know, they seem like they weighed 80 pounds or 100 pounds. Now we have somebody who's about 60 pounds soaking wet carrying a proton accelerator pack. I know, fine, I'm just being salty, but okay. However, rather than beginning from a place of profit, anticipation, or outright nostalgia bait, Reitman explained that every story I've ever told began with a character and noted, in the case of Afterlife, it was a 12-year-old standing in a field with a proton pack. At first, I didn't know who she was, he continued. Eventually, I knew she'd be a genius who found the Neutrona. The Neutrona one in her grandfather's basement. I knew her brother would find the Ecto-1 in the barn and go joyriding. Eventually, I realized that she was a Spengler. The Spenglers, Reitman explained, are a single mom and two kids, and they are a family that loves one another but struggles to connect. When anyone is born into a family, they arrive in a mystery that started with generations before them, the director said. Part of any life is trying to figure out where you came from and what drama led to your arrival. I don't really think about that ever, do you? I don't know. Maybe I don't think about that. This is the moment in which we find Phoebe and Trevor. You know, Ghostbusters is currently set to release on November 18th, and I am kind of getting excited for it. You know, I don't understand. You look at some of these comments. Is it so hard to understand the secret to Ghostbusters' success in large measure was its cast? It's hard to go wrong when you have Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd in the same movie, both at the height of their careers. Don't expect much from Ghostbusters' movie. You can't get a cast together of that same caliber. It's the same thing with all these remakes. You can't get anything off the ground when you don't have the same kind of talent pool to draw from that they did back in the 70s and 80s. It's actually an excellent point. Excellent point. And yeah, I mean, I do think that this Ghostbusters movie looks like it's made for kids. You know, I don't think that's for me. Will I see it? I don't know. If it's streaming, I'll definitely watch it. But there are other movies that I want to give my money to, you know, that I will support in the cinema. And there are plenty of movies that I'd rather just watch at home. And right now, Ghostbusters Afterlife went from a film that I was fine ignoring to one that I'll definitely at least give a watch. I never had any interest whatsoever in Ghostbusters 2016, like most people, and I wasn't going to be bullied into seeing it. Ghostbusters Afterlife at least is tied to the original universe, but like that previous commenter expertly pointed out, Ghostbusters worked because it had, you know, just an excellent cast. Everybody, there was no wasted cast at all. You can't forget even Sigourney Weaver. You can't forget Rick Moranis, you know, Harold Ramis. Everybody. I can't remember the guy's name who plays Winston Zeddemore. Why can't I think of his name? He's awesome. He goes on. He still does the convention circuit. He's awesome with fans. Why can't I think of it? Yeah. I mean, the Gate Master Key Master and Gatekeeper side story was good, but it was great because of the characters that played them, because Rick Moranis crushed it. Even the secretary, she has, you know, she starts, I mean, she's got a storyline that leads into the second movie, and she's a great actress. It's like they have an embarrassment of riches in the original Ghostbusters movie. Embarrassment. I don't think there's anybody that sucks in that movie. I mean, Rick Moranis talking about tax code and having a, he has a party, but he's such a loser. He only invites work friends so he can write it off. Like, stuff like that is gold. And, like, Rick Moranis absolutely crushes that role. So, you know, I don't know that we're ever going to recapture that. And that's just fine. This movie can exist, but I'm definitely on the fence about it. I hope you enjoyed this video. We'll talk to you again real soon.